This is the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast for March 5th, 2024. Welcome to the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast, where we talk about everything by talking about games. My name is Drew Messenger Michaels. I'm your host. I'm real glad you're here, and I am real glad to be back after the first hiatus we've taken since the show went bi-weekly. I had a gig making music and designing sounds and doing overall sound design, designing the whole auditory experience for a game. I love doing that. I want to do a whole lot more of that. I had to give that some attention. I had to give my new day job, which is in tech but not in games, the attention that it deserved. It was good to step away for a minute and think through what the podcast is going to be going forward. Speaking of, when the show hit the 10-year mark last August, which is still wild to think about, I started doing a bonus feed, and the idea of the bonus feed was that the episodes there didn't necessarily have to fit into the long-form interview format that the main show has fit into pretty much from the jump. We've always done in-house discussion episodes, but the bread and butter has always been me talking to someone who makes games in some way. But in the bonus feed, maybe I do some research, maybe I get some friends and family to read some relevant quotes, and I more present an essay, some thoughts about a game and about what a game makes us think about. Again, the whole talking about everything by talking about games thing. And as I started getting ready to start doing the main show again, and as I tried to book guests in this moment when so many people are getting laid off, and in this moment when Twitter has become functionally unusable, and therefore a way of introducing yourself to someone you kind of internet know or even don't know at all has basically gone away, it occurred to me that really the main show needed to change too. If I'm going to bring you something worth listening to every 2 weeks, which I think I absolutely can, that thing may not necessarily be an interview every time. I am sometimes going to do some research, think about a game, and talk into a microphone, and that'll be the main episode. What that leaves the Ultra Deluxe feed, as we call it, being, I'm still figuring out. But the main show is going to be a little bit more experimental. We're going to play with format and see how else we can talk about games. If you are here for the interviews, first and foremost, first, last, always, only, that is fine. We are still going to do those. If you just want to tune into those episodes, I will mark them as clearly as I can. Obviously, guest names are always in the episode titles when there's a guest. Let me know if that's not clear enough for you, if we need bracket tags or something. I don't want anyone to feel like they're getting tricked into listening to something they don't want to listen to, but I do want to set the precedent that you can tune in and hear something worthwhile and game adjacent without necessarily knowing ahead of time exactly what that's going to be. If I can get your trust and your interest in that way, then I feel like I'm doing my job, low in this second decade of the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast project. So for a first outing in this brave new world, I am going to air what was going to be the next bonus episode as a regular episode. This is the first in a series I was doing while the show was on hiatus, where I played unexpectedly popular games that have come out this year, and there've been like all kinds of weird breakout hits, and did some thinking about them, both engaging with them as games you can play and thinking about them in a broader cultural context. Why did they get popular? Why might people be upset that they're popular? In the case at least of this first example, Palworld. I'm keenly aware that the world has moved on from talking about Palworld, but I think it's worth reflecting on a little bit. I recorded this a little closer to when this was in the zeitgeist. Maybe this format eternally puts me behind the viral content curve, but when have I been afraid of that? Again, hopefully it's an interesting and worthwhile thing to spend a few minutes listening to. So that's the plan. Thanks to anyone who has listened to this point, anyone who's going to listen in the future, who's listening now, all of the above is so appreciated. Let's try something new. Enjoy. Part 1. Relaxaurus, or a ludic reading of Palworld. So let's talk about Palworld. This is a game you've probably heard a little something about from an upstart Japanese studio called Pocket Pair. And from the moment of its first intentionally controversy-baiting trailer, it has been pegged as Pokemon with guns, a thing that the Pokemon company itself has been understandably reluctant to deliver over the years. When you play it, though, you see that it's ripping off Ark, for example, just as much as it's ripping off Pokemon, and therefore, the real primary pitch is actually Pokemon with co-op. a thing that the Pokemon Company has been, somewhat less understandably, reluctant to deliver over the years. Pokemon Scarlet and Violet, the most recent mainline entries in the series, sort of talked about co-op as a central feature in the preview content leading up to their release, but when they came out, the co-op element was extremely thin. You could wander around in the world together catching Pokemon, but you could not catch Pokemon together. You certainly could not take on gym leaders together. So yeah, the fact that you can help a friend catch a not Pokemon in Pal World is immediately appealing. Likewise, the fact that the tower bosses, the equivalent to gym leader battles, or the closest thing the game has, are group affairs. Now, granted, two players being able to damage the same monster in a shared co-op world, or bosses being big HP soaks with time limits such that you need other people to DPS them down within those time limits, these are not blazingly original pieces of design. What's sort of striking is that they don't have to be. It doesn't take much to add stuff that mainline Pokemon has never had. Likewise, the game's best joke is that making dark, edgy Pokemon often doesn't require changing that much about Pokemon. If you're writing parody lyrics to a song, often the funniest thing you can do is change the meaning of a line without changing very many, perhaps even without changing any words. And Pal World's best jokes function more or less like that. Just make beating the monster up before you throw them in the ball that much more like beating them up, as opposed to having a fun fight before they faint. Extend the creeping horror of these creatures suddenly becoming compliant once you put them in the ball by making them into workers. Address the upsetting notion of what might happen if you put a human in a Pokeball, or Pal Sphere. Pal World, to be clear, does not do much with these ideas, but it's amusing that it doesn't have to in order to puncture Pokemon's usual whimsical, gentle, don't think about it too much tone. And Pal World's best idea, its best combination of ideas from a gameplay perspective, the thing that I might even deign to call ambitious, is the combination of monster collection with base management and automation. You don't just want that fire type because it can fight ice types, you want it so that it can cook or smelt while you're out adventuring. That's neat. And while it's by no means wrong to call Pal World a shameless ripoff of all sorts of things in all sorts of ways, to call something a shameless ripoff is usually to imply that there's some other classier, less derivative version of the same idea you could go play, and in this case, there isn't, to my knowledge. There isn't a creature collection, base management, and automation game. There isn't a co-op Pokemon game, at least not an officially commercially released one. Pal World was, if only very briefly, a huge hit. It broke the record for most concurrent players playing a single game at a single time on Steam, and then pretty quickly lost about two-thirds of that player base. Maybe temporarily. This isn't even that weird for an early access game. People get excited, they play it, it's trendy, they do everything there currently is to do, and then they either will or won't be back when there either is or isn't more stuff to do. But yes, any analysis of the game or of why it got popular, even briefly, does have to include how little it has to do to be doing much more than mainline Pokemon. Sure, Pal World's open world is frequently sparse and incoherent to the point of surreality. Sure, the game is janky to the point that it frequently ceases to function. But, and I really don't think I'm breaking any news here, those things are pretty true of Scarlet and Violet as well, of the most recent mainline Pokemon games. Games that, to be perfectly clear, I really enjoyed, jank and all. But any honest accounting of what Pal World is and why it might have gotten popular has to include the ways in which it does clear the bar, and also of how low the bar truly is. Such an account must also, of course, include the edginess. Most of the edgy shit in Pal World is just kind of nothing. When you use a Pal Sphere and do not capture the pal you're trying to capture, the on-screen text calls it a cheeky bastard. This is unlikely to offend your sensibilities, unlikely to give you a transgressive thrill, unlikely to make you deeply embarrassed about playing the game. It just isn't anything. Now, that said, sometimes when Pal World does the most basic, the most sophomoric, the most straightforwardly dark version of whatever it's doing, it actually works pretty well. Cops in this game are venal and violent and infinitely lazy and endlessly corruptible. And yeah, that's just a quick, dark version of what if this but bad, but it's also a much more accurate representation of cops than you usually get in a video game. Elsewhere, the Pal Dex entry for King Paka, who is, yes, a giant alpaca wearing a crown, tells us that this king frequently has his vassals fight to the death for his royal amusement, which again is just a quick, edgy, dark joke about a cute character, but is also again, a much more accurate representation of what having kings around means for normal people than you usually get in fantasy stories that are sort of obsessed with the idea of just rule and true kings and so forth. And yes, this is Pokemon with guns, but it's also Pokemon with guns. Sure, I can pick up an assault rifle in this game as I can in a functional infinity of other games, and in this game, I can use that assault rifle to shoot a Relaxaurus. But why would I give a shit about that when I can also give my Relaxaurus a rocket launcher? Pokemon with guns. That's getting there. That's over the top. That's something that Nintendo doesn't let us do. Palworld's first trailer, though, promised a different kind of darkness. It had footage of large numbers of pals slaving away on munitions assembly lines, getting consigned to dark satanic mills. The game as it currently exists doesn't actually offer much opportunity for that. For one thing, putting them indoors really fucks up their already pretty dodgy pathfinding, so it's really better to have kind of a plain air munitions factory, even if that's the way you want to go. And beyond that, the game just doesn't prompt you to be all that evil all that often. Fairly early on, you unlock the ability to work your pals harder, to increase the brutality of conditions in exchange for more efficient production, but there isn't really much of a reason to. Maybe I just don't have optimization brain the way that some people who play video games do. In fact, I'm pretty sure that's the case, but I just didn't really see any reason to do anything other than let them work at their own fairly humane pace while I went out and adventured and found more pals, stronger ones, more efficient ones, as well as new materials, which then made the efficiency just sort of ramp up naturally. I guess that if I did have optimization brain, I could have continued catching pals and continued churning through low-level ones by overworking them and then replacing them with other low-level ones, rinse, repeat. That feels like some kind of commentary if the game wants you to do that, but it also feels like there's no real point to doing that, which itself kind of feels like commentary. The game has an intuitive sense that capturing Pokemon-ish creatures and using them for manual labor is fucked up in some way, but it doesn't have a strong point of view about why that's fucked up, about what's fucked up about that. This dulls the edges of the edginess, and it weakens the game as a satire or even as a parody, but it also has this unexpected effect of making the whole thing feel kinda nice. The pals work for me. They've lost their autonomy. That aspect of the critique of capitalism, such as it is intact, right? The idea that if this is how our world works more than how the Pokemon world works, we're not the people, we're the pals. Sure, point made, I suppose. But my pals are working in a sort of pre-industrial context, a cottage industry context. They do what I tell them, but they do it at their own pace. They take breaks whenever they feel like it, they eat when they're hungry, they take some time in the hot spring if they're feeling stressed. The ability to create newer and better machinery, newer and better equipment, comes from venturing further into the world, not from ramping up the efficiency of production, so there isn't really a reason to industrialize in that sense. Maybe true factories are planned for a future update, maybe that will or won't make the critique sharper, but for the moment, the process of putting pals to work actually has a tone much closer to the Pokemon series' usual, whimsical, gentle, don't-think-about-it tone. Even if the way it rides right up to the line makes it pretty clear why the Pokemon Company themselves probably wouldn't make a game about base automation. Lest I be accused of an incomplete analysis, there are a few more explicitly bastardly mechanics in the game. There's breeding, basically right out of Pokemon, where two pals hang out and then an egg just sort of appears. But as you breed a whole bunch of pals you probably don't have any particular use for or simply catch more than you need, there's also a condensing mechanic. You can put a whole bunch of the same pal in what looks like a big blender to make one better pal. This is, of course, just a sort of a reskin of an extremely common gashapon mechanic, but this does feel evil. Callous. Fucked up. Dark. Edgy. It does seem like to get the very best and most eugenic version of a given pal, you've got to do this. So this is the one and only instance of the game tempting you to be evil by offering you power available only to bastards. But honestly, the moment where I felt like the biggest bastard during my time with Palworld came from what I'm pretty sure was just jank. I was out hunting a pack of Relaxaurus for their high-quality pal oil, and these things usually confront you, but one of them, having seen me kill a bunch of its brethren, ran away. And it ran to the top of a hill where it didn't really have anywhere else to go, and it just stood there, facing away from me and toward the horizon. This was almost certainly its pathfinding, being unable to find a path, plain and simple, but the impression, the undeniable impression in that moment, was that this creature was looking out at one last sunset before I murdered it in cold blood for a pretty small amount of some stupid resource. This made me feel like enough of a bastard to re-examine my entire life, and every day since I've made time to watch the sunset while petting my dogs. And again, I'm quite confident that this was not an intentionally crafted moment, that the game's systems are not built to create moments like this one. This was just jank hitting right. But it did sort of get me thinking about how grindy games like this one put you in a strange trance, where little numinous moments of meaning peeking through can hit really hard. And let's be quite explicit, yes, this game is, by and large, a grindy mess. It's yet another survival craft-em-up. That's just a way of bringing you back for the long term. Leveling, and tech trees, and on and on and on. But I think at this point in game history, we should probably just accept that that is a way of making a game gamey. And two things are simultaneously true here for me. First, I would like my games to be less gamey, in general. But then two, if a game is going to be gamey, if it's going to try and sink its hooks into me in one way or another, then I would strongly prefer an escalating hierarchy of workbenches over a seasonal battle pass. Part 2, Copperjaw, or a Luddite reading of Pal World. Okay, so this has been an exercise in talking about Pal World on something like its own terms without immediately acknowledging the Copperjaw in the room, namely, that some of these designs look an awful lot like specific Pokemon, and many more of them look like chimeras of specific parts of specific Pokemon. Not all of them, to be clear, not the aforementioned Relaxaurus, not Lee's Punk, not King Paka, long may he brutally and unjustly reign. But there's no denying the chimera-sized Pokemon element of a whole bunch of the designs, and I think we should talk about that from a couple of different angles. First, there's the question of why Nintendo hasn't sued the pants off Pocket Pair, despite usually being so litigious about things like fan games. I can't claim to know. Perhaps that shoe has yet to drop. I will, however, echo George Albor on the Experience Points podcast, who pointed out that in any kind of sane intellectual property regime, Pikachu would be in the public domain by now. If we presume that Pocket Pair did, in fact, just rip off a bunch of design elements from specific Pokemon wholesale, that does seem to be holding them back aesthetically. Again, the ones where they don't seem to have done that are their best designs, by and large. But I don't have, like, an ethical objection to stealing shit from Nintendo. The hoarding of intellectual property is a grander theft than you or I could ever possibly commit. If you can lift some intellectual property from Nintendo or Disney or whoever and get away with it, more power to you. I'm not a cop. For me, then, the more serious accusation is the one about Pocket Pair ripping off fan designs for Pokemon without crediting or compensating the creators. That seems to be an open question as to whether they actually did that, but if they did, yes, fuck them, and fuck that. They should make that right. The ethics of ripping off some small creator are extremely different from the ethics of ripping off a giant, litigious megacorp. It's funny, though, because usually part of the calculus is that the plagiarizer thinks they can get away with it if they rip off smaller creators. See H-Bomber Guy's recent mega video essay about YouTube plagiarism. Pocket Pair seems to have been unusually indiscriminate here, and we can decry the dipshittery of ripping off small creators while also somewhat admiring the chutzpah of ripping off Nintendo, and while acknowledging the cynicism of both. Speaking of cynicism, there's one more angle we need to talk about, and to me it's the most confusing one. Namely, the accusation that Pocket Pair achieved these chimeric PAL designs by means of so-called generative AI. I say that this accusation is confusing because it seems to belie a perfectly understandable misunderstanding of how AI works. It is true that so-called generative AI absorbs a bunch of sources and then slaps together the results into ostensibly original but fundamentally unoriginal products. So it makes sense, in that sense, to look at derivative rip-off-y Pokemon-ish designs, particularly ones composed of component parts of several Pokemon, and say, AI Pokemon. But the three or four different Pokemon of which some PALs seem to be combinations, that's just not a sufficient number of sources for any generative AI technology that I'm aware of. Hell, the 1,000 Pokemon that there are isn't really a sufficient number of sources. Unless, of course, you have a lot of examples of each, which you do as far as overall Pokemon imagery, but I don't think you do in the specific case of 3D models, which, to my understanding, are the things that we're claiming have been consumed and chimericized and spat back out by a so-called generative AI here. If we're saying that the folks at Pocket Pair used some kind of so-called generative AI to decide what parts to steal from which Pokemon, but then did the stealing by hand, I don't love that, but that is super different from what I think they're being accused of. The thievery happening here seems like a very human kind of thievery, and we are, as ever, just giving so-called AI way too much credit. I could be out in front of my skis here, but I just really don't think there is a program that you can tell to create usable 3D models of Pokemon-ish creatures. Much less usable 3D models of Pokemon-ish creatures that skate right up to the line of legality without crossing it. Functioning within the law as far as intellectual property goes is famously something that so-called generative AI is really bad at, to the point that Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, has straight up said that they couldn't function as a business. They would have no business model if they had to respect intellectual property law as it currently exists. We should note, of course, that the CEO of PocketPair, for his part, has talked quite freely about using AI bullshit in various projects, past, present, future, but here's the thing about that. What seems undeniable here is that PocketPair did not put enough time or emphasis, did not place enough value on character design as an artistic practice. We are talking about artists' jobs here, but it's important to remember that machines do not take away people's jobs or make them worse. Bosses do that. It almost doesn't matter what part so-called generative AI did or did not play in the creation of Palworld, because the way automation functions, if we take a broader historical view, is as a threat. We're in this moment with so-called generative AI, this moment in the hype cycle, where sure, if you look at the output too closely, it sucks and isn't really usable and certainly isn't a replacement for human labor, but what about the inevitable future where it doesn't suck, where it can completely replace human labor? We better go ahead and just start paying artists less now on the assumption that that magical machine will someday exist. By buying into the hype about the magical machine, then workers make it much easier for their bosses to exploit them. A boss might say, okay, I don't have to pay these character designers as much because a machine now exists or could soon exist that works more or less like Palworld's own condensing blender. I throw in a bunch of Pokemon and I get something usable out of it. If we're going to push back against that, and we should, we must, one of the most important things we can do is remember that that machine doesn't exist. The threat only works if we fail to remember that historically speaking, it's an empty threat. It's been effective, don't get me wrong, but it's always been a bluff. Let's remember that CEOs need artists specifically because there is no button a CEO can press to automate away artistry. Full automation in basically any context is and has always been and will probably always be a myth. Actual factories have been chasing that dream since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and there still isn't really a single thing in the world that is made completely without human intervention. Talking about the magical machine when we should be talking about labor makes it that much harder to organize around valuing people's labor properly. So let's not linger too much on in what way or whether Palworld's development included the use of so-called generative AI, both because at this point we kinda can't know, and because if we take a broader historical view, it kinda doesn't matter. Instead, let's acknowledge the anxiety behind the accusation, all of the extremely legit things that artists can't help but think when they see Palworld and its enormous success. To wit, and even beyond the core labor issues we're talking about, having one's work non-consensually incorporated into a so-called generative AI model is an extremely valid concern. That's a thing we need to fight. Getting hired to make a game and then spending a bunch of that development time slapping together Pokemon parts is bleak to think about. PocketPair's whole thing does seem to be to slap together things people like, from Palworld to their upcoming Hollow Knight Dead Cells farm sim thing. And even when the results are actually kind of fun or interesting to play, there is something remarkably cynical about that endeavor. And if PocketPair has indeed ripped off fan works without contacting, crediting, or compensating the creators, then yes, that is awful. That would be reason enough for me personally to be done with the studio's work permanently, or at the very least until they make it right with the creators they've harmed and make some big changes on how things work going forward. These things matter more than the game itself, frankly, but they also make it harder to talk about the game itself, because Palworld kinda short-circuited people's brains for a minute there. It's so derivative, and yet there isn't anything else on the market quite like it. It's kind of bland, and yet the flavors, mild though they may be, are not available elsewhere. It's much edgier than it needs to be, but also much less edgy than it means to be. It's not by any means a sharp satire, but it does have things to say if you're paying attention, and if you're not too hung up on whether those statements are intentional. It is a profoundly derivative work, one of undeniable cynicism and perhaps even malevolence, but shot through with elements of playfulness and invention. There's a single question at the center of everything with Palworld, the question I think that haunts us and that broke all of our brains briefly. Namely, Is this what art is going to be like now?
Ooh, when the sun stopped shining, showed me the silver lining, hell of my lonesome hour.
And that's the show. The Everybody's Talking at Once podcast is hosted and produced by me, Drew Messenger Michaels, with support from Francis Michelle Cannon, Lucio Valentino, and El Viegas. Our logo is by Aaron Perry Zucker, using icons from The Noun Project. The current version of our theme song is by me. You can find more music that I make at carpedemon.band, and maybe some more places soon. Really appreciate you listening. There is zero pressure to do anything other than listen, but if you really like the show and would like to support us further, I super appreciate that, and here's what you can do. You can tell a friend about the show, you can leave us a good rating or review, or if and only if it causes you no financial hardship of even the slightest kind, you can throw us a few bucks at patreon.com/etao. Immense thanks to our Patreonizers, with a special thanks to Carlos de los Santos and Darth Raptura. And an even specialer thanks to the mysterious Ian Kay, Lucas Cosin, and Sylvain Dufresne. Hope to see you in 2 weeks. What will you hear if you do show up at that point? I can't honestly tell you, and hopefully that's exciting. Till then, do take care of yourselves, do take care of each other. So long for now, everybody.